This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, the weekend edition of Family Research Council's Washington Watch.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm your host, David Salkeld, the constitutional conservative, husband, and homeschool dad. Well, the first week of President Donald Trump's administration has been a whirlwind of activity, and there have been some great policy wins for conservatives. But there has also been a lot of divisive chatter from the other side, and we'll talk with Bishop Harry Jackson about that a little later in the show. However, on Monday of this week, President Trump signed an executive order reinstating the pro-life Mexico City policy, preventing your tax dollars from funding abortions overseas. Representative Mark Meadows, chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, joined Family Research Council President Tony Perkins with that story.
Mark, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, it's great to be back with you, and certainly it's a good day following the inauguration just a little bit less than 72 hours ago, and to see the action that our new commander-in-chief took today with the pen, and really it was a real shout-out, but not only a shout-out, but it was real action on behalf of the unborn that we certainly applaud.
Not surprised, because he had said that he was going to be a pro-life president more forcefully than any other Republican nominee that I can recall. But this order is actually a little stronger than some may have anticipated.
Well, it is. It's stronger. They've been working on it over the weekend, as you know. It really, for me, is a real confirmation that but not only the vote that I took and that you took and that many others took to have a president that would be pro-life, but one that actually followed through and delivered on his promises. And so to take this order and really say that this is going to be foreign policy, and to be able to stand the criticism that, you know, that the left is certainly going to wage against him because of it, I think not only do Americans should they be applauding, but they should be very thankful that we have a president who not only says what he means, but means what he says
and acts on it. You know, we've had a lot of speeches and a lot of political rhetoric, but he's actually doing it. And he made that point in the inaugural address where he said, you know, it's time for action. And so he's showing that here, rolling up his sleeves and going to work. Now, this executive order, which was signed earlier today, it's one day after the anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision back in 1973. Now, tell our listeners exactly what this executive order does, the implications of this from a practical standpoint of American foreign policy.
Well, it really reaches well beyond our borders. It sends not only a message to those countries that we interact with on a regular basis about the priorities of this administration, but what it also says is that federal tax dollars is not going to be used for abortion or forced sterilization, a number of things that moms and dads on Main Street would just find not only offensive, but they can't believe that their tax dollars would be used for. And so it also goes beyond that for those non-governmental organizations to say that you can't indirectly use that money to support these types of activities. I think it's a new day in foreign policy as well, Tony. I think what we have is a president who says that you may have been getting a message over the last 8 years from our State Department and from Washington, D.C., but that message is changing, and it's going to be one that is about families and pro-life and initiatives that are important to the American people, both domestically and strategically.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Glad to have you with us on this Monday afternoon, post-inauguration Monday. My guest, North Carolina Congressman Mark Meadows, who is the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus. Now, Mark, let me ask you this. Where the State Department has been during the Barack Obama years, also using money through USAID, the U.S. agency for development. They have been using money to agitate and try to force countries or encourage countries, I'll be kind, to change their laws as it pertains to abortion. Where do we stand with that? Will this order in any way affect the way that money is spent, where it's not directly going to abortion, but it's trying to get nations that are pro-life to change their policies?
Well, it will address that, but there is more work, as you know, that needs to be done there from the very top, from our commander-in-chief, as he sets forth his priorities with regards to the State Department or USAID. One of the biggest complaints that I've had are from African countries who are working to try to make sure that they provide jobs and educate and sometimes just feed their people. And yet we have advanced a social policy, either directly or indirectly, trying to make that aid contingent upon them embracing things that go against their culture, whether that's a Christian culture or a Muslim culture. Many times we see that over and over again. So this will actually send a very clear message that it is a new day, not only in Washington, D.C., but from here around the globe and in between, that it is important that we look at those that are in harm's way and provide that humanitarian relief, but yet at the same time not put some of the social strings that are attached to it in trying to affect domestic policy in abroad.
So, Congressman Meadows, let me make sure that our listeners understand what you were saying. What the way our State Department has been operating is that they have, in these nations that have great humanitarian needs, food, basic supplies that we have been helping to assist them in feeding their people and taking care of these basic necessities, they have said, all right, if you want this, you got to change policies on abortion. They've tied the money to the changing of these policies, trying to impose a liberal view that we don't even necessarily have here in this country on these other countries?
Without a doubt, your analysis is spot on, and sometimes it's subtly, sometimes it's not so subtle. I mean, I've talked to foreign leaders of different countries, and they have said, well, we would rather not take the assistance from your country because you are challenging our beliefs at its very core. Now, and when we look at that, when we are looking at some of the people that are desperate for humanitarian aid, and we're trying to attach it to some other agenda that some liberal might have in a previous administration, I think it would go against just who we are as a people, and obviously is something that needs to be changed. And so I see this as the start of that. I again applaud the president for his willingness to take a bold move very early on, and in the keeping of Ronald Reagan's action so many years ago, we see that revisited. I think people are going to be very surprised about a president who not only talks the talk, but is willing to take action unlike any before.
You can find a link to Representative Mark Meadows' website and his Twitter feed when you visit tonyperkins.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back with a look at some of the shocking rhetoric coming from the left. We'll be back with more of the weekend edition of Washington Watch right after this.
What will Donald do during his first 100 days in office? Family Research Council has laid out a conservative playbook for the president-elect to follow in order to repair some of the damage done by the Obama administration's liberal elite special interests. In a timely panel discussion, policy experts lay out a game plan of actions that the Trump administration can take in its first 100 days. Visit frc.org/first100 to view this policy discussion.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. Since the inauguration, there have been protests and marches all over the country, but what you hear from those events is often X-rated. On Tuesday, Bishop Harry Jackson, who leads Hope Christian Church in Beltsville, Maryland, joined Tony to discuss those events.
Last night, candidates aspiring to take over as chairman, chairperson, chair something of the Democratic National Committee met to discuss what went wrong in 2016. Now, the meeting turned into a hate fest. Now, listen to this. I got a clip for you from last night. This is the executive director of Idaho's Democratic Party, Sally Brown.
I am so excited that we're here, and I am listening, because that's my job. My job is to listen to the issues. My job is to listen and be a voice. And my job is to shut other white people down when they want to interrupt. My job is to shut other white people down when they want to say, oh no, I'm not prejudiced. I'm a Democrat. I'm accepting. My job is to make sure that they get, that they have privilege. And until we shut our mouths and we listen to those people who don't, and we lift our people up, so that we all have equity in this country, so that we're all fighting alongside each other, so that we're all on the same page, and we clearly get where we're going, we're not going to break through this. This is not just rhetoric. This is life or death. This moment in our country, the Democratic Party has the opportunity to do something different. We have the opportunity to really confront the fact that we have not been in alignment with our values. We've been talking a lot of smack.
So, the pathway forward for the Democratic Party is to tell white folks to sit down and shut up. Well, Bishop Harry Jackson of Hope Christian Church in Beltsville, Maryland, joins us to give us his take on that. Bishop Jackson, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, good to be with you, and what a week this has been, huh?
It has been quite a week, but it looks like the Democratic Party, liberals are coming unhinged in the fact that I think they were so shocked and surprised by the loss in the election, they just don't know how to handle it.
Absolutely. They're still looking for the reason why, and I believe they are espousing their values and creating, attempting to create momentum through demonization of their political opponents and creating more schism, separating us on the basis of race, on the basis of gender, and other than that, that's the only thing they can really think to do now is let's demonize Mr. Trump, paint him as he is a part of some racist movement that's going to wipe people out, is going to do away with the little guy economically, et cetera. So it's an interesting time. I'm sure these tactics, Tony, won't work.
Well, I would think it would backfire. Although I'm happy for them to continue because I think it actually helps conservatives out. But the two groups where they lost such standing in this election was number one, those that identify as evangelicals. Believe it or not, there were evangelicals that voted for Barack Obama. 81% of them this time around voted for Donald Trump, a record number. But also in the white males in larger numbers turned out and voted for Donald Trump, in large part, I think, because of this type of rhetoric that has become at the core of the Democratic Party's message.
That's exactly right. I think that when I hear this, as an African-American male, I think it's patronizing. I think about how can somebody who is from Idaho, where they've got three black people at the post office, I'm just joking, but there's a very small percentage of African Americans, but the identity of the party is wrapped up in selling false dreams to minorities and to the least of these in the culture. So I think that's a problem. And I saw a picture that was sent to me by one of my parishioners that showed Donald Trump with his parents, and his parents were holding up what ostensibly were KKK outfits or robes. And I reached back to this person and said, do not pass that on. Can't you see that picture is photoshopped? So all during the election, the claim of racism, claim of misogyny or prejudice against women, and the claim that you're going to bring your billionaire friends in and squash the little guy, that's about as sophisticated as the Democrats were able to get this time around in this election.
Well, and I guess we will see. We will see how the average American fares under the policies of Donald Trump. And I would venture to say that all Americans, regardless of their ethnic background or their economic class, will be better off after the policies of Donald Trump have taken grip. Bishop Harry Jackson, as always, great to have you on the program. Sorry we're out of time, up against a break, but we'll visit again real soon.
Love to do it, Tony. Thanks for having me.
You can find out more about Bishop Harry Jackson when you visit TonyPerkins.com. Don't go away. We'll be back with more of the weekend edition of Washington Watch right after this.
From the ruling to uphold Obamacare's individual mandate, to the ruling to redefine marriage, to the ruling that allows the government to seize a citizen's home, these are the many important decisions that the United States Supreme Court has made recently. But did you know that each of these three decisions was determined by a one-vote margin? The Supreme Court's decisions affect all of us, and it decides about 70 cases every year. Over the next 8 years, we could get as many as 4 new Supreme Court justices. Furthermore, these justices will have a huge impact on the sanctity of human life, religious liberty, and the size and scope of government, and even parental rights. Join Family Research Council Action as we work to ensure the confirmation of Supreme Court justices who will uphold the Constitution and simply apply the law as the founders intended. Become a member today at frcaction.org. That's frcaction.org.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm David Salkeld. The week after the inauguration found the Republicans and the Democrats leaving Washington, D.C. to hold their annual retreats. Arizona Representative Trent Franks joined Tony on Thursday from the Republican retreat in Philadelphia.
Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hello from Philadelphia, Mr. Tony.
Have you been to see the Liberty Bell?
I have in the past, yes, sir. I haven't this trip, but I've seen it. It's a magnificent thing to see. Really, you know, kind of brings it all home, doesn't it?
It does. You know, I actually like Philadelphia. I've had a chance to go up there a number of times and just tour, and actually different times taken one of my kids up and just spent a couple of days touring the area. You know, Gettysburg's not too far from there.
Yes, sir.
There's the Valley Forge. We've got so many things to see. It's just a fascinating city. Of course, what's fascinating now is this point in history that we are at, where the Republicans have control of the House and the Senate, the White House. A lot of responsibility comes with that authority that's been given to the Republicans by voters. One of the top issues, I know you've been discussing it quite a bit. I've been discussing it with your colleagues in the last 12 to 24 hours, is the issue of Obamacare, repealing it and replacing it. Some complications on the replace side.
Well, that's an understatement, Tony. You know, they talk often about the 60-vote rule there, but really it's two rules. One is the motion to proceed to consider. That means to get a bill to the floor for debate and amendment. It takes 60 votes in the Senate to do that, other than on reconciliation. And reconciliation allows you to go around that. Now, it's always amazing to me that some of my friends that think I'm overly concerned about gridlock in the Senate, they say, well, we'll do this through reconciliation. Well, if it's okay to do it through reconciliation, why isn't it okay to do it through a slight rule change? But the problem we have is that we have the power through reconciliation, which only requires 51 votes to get it to the floor and to vote on it. We have the power to repeal the foundations of Obamacare, the financial underpinnings of it. But then we have to be able to replace it with something that requires at least 8 Democrats to join us. And the Democrats have said steadfastly they're not going to do that. And my even greater fear is that they might join us on something, but demand sort of out of a hostage-taking syndrome, demand some policy mechanism that would completely vitiate our whole reason for replacing, and that ultimately it would hurt the country and deliberately hurt Republicans. And I don't know what we're going to do about that. I mean, I spoke to Senator McConnell about even to put things on the floor like Born Alive on the Senate, and he was not helpful at all. I just have to tell you, this country is going to have to come to grips with this 60-vote rule in the Senate. Otherwise, it doesn't matter whether we have the majority or not. The Democrats still have the ability to put their foot on the throat of the Constitution and the Republic.
And Senator Chuck Schumer, who is leading that Democratic delegation there in the Senate, has made very clear that he will do just that. I did hear from your colleagues that you spoke out on the life issue, asking those questions. And I've had a number of conversations regarding the replace provision that they're trying to put into the reconciliation, which is kind of hard to fit it in. But some concerns, Trent, about the issue of abortion still being funded in that reconciliation bill the way it's being structured.
Yeah, well, here's what the concern is, Tony. Under the Republican plan, people would receive the people that, you know, need help that are in the economic circumstance where they need help to, with their insurance, they would receive a refundable tax credit to buy private insurance from the private sector. Now, I am fully in favor of that. I love that.
Right.
But the idea is that if they receive, they have to spend it on insurance. And the idea is, like you, I don't want any kind of taxpayer imprimatur on buying insurance that includes killing children in it.
Abortion is not health care.
It's not health care. No, it's the absolute antithesis of health care. Health care is to preserve and protect life. You know, the doctor, primum non nocere, you know, first do no harm. Abortion is the absolute opposite of that. So those of us that are concerned about that say simply that that any health care or insurance that could be purchased by this would have to be absent abortion coverage. And if someone wanted more abortion coverage, even though you know that I'm committed to protecting the unborn, but if there was abortion coverage, that it would have to come as a completely separate thing where it would be paid for by private dollars. Because we just got off the floor here this last week, as you know, of putting in statute, at least on the House side, the Hyde Amendment, which would permanently say we're not going to force taxpayers to pay for the killing of American children.
Right. And this is, so what we're looking at here is, because of reconciliation, the method that's being used to repeal Obamacare, and then they're trying to replace it with another plan, we're being told that there are limits so that those restrictions on those tax credits cannot be put in place to ensure that tax dollars are not going to abortion. So essentially what we have, if this goes forward, is a very similar, you know, accounting gimmick that the Obamacare used. It's a subsidy by a different name. And I can tell you that, and I know you know this because you've been saying it up there at the retreat. I've talked to the chairman of the Freedom Caucus. I've talked to the chairman of the RSC, and they're of the same mind that's a non-starter.
It could be fixed, Tony. This can be fixed. We can say no. We're not going to use a refundable tax credit to support or promote or subsidize any abortion coverage. We're just not going to do it. We just went through that debate, and we're saying that taxpayers should not be forced to do that. And if there's any abortion coverage, people should have to buy that themselves. Now, you understand, I say that in the context of the funding mechanism.
Right.
I believe that the unborn child should be protected in the law.
I got it.
Yeah, you understand.
I understand completely.
I know you understand. I guess I'm saying it for your listeners.
Yeah. I mean, what he's saying, folks, is that the you know what he's saying, but let me just say what he's saying. He's saying that people can do with their own money what they want to do. We may not agree with it, but they can do it. But they cannot with taxpayer money. We cannot be a part of setting up a structure where your tax dollars would go toward funding abortion. The House just voted on that earlier this week to say, no, we're not going to have taxpayer funding of abortion. So why would we put it into the replace version of Obamacare? Is that right, Trent? That's what you're saying.
That's exactly right. You know, and I know you understood that, Tony, and I appreciate you making it clear to the folks. You know, when we did this last week, I went on the floor and I simply said this. You know, we're always talking past each other, and I think sometimes deliberately on the side of the left, we're never really dealing with the real issue. The real issue with abortion is really one question. There's really one question here, and that is, does abortion kill a little baby? If it doesn't, Tony, I'm ready to stop talking about it.
Yeah.
But if abortion kills a baby, then you and I in this Washington, D.C., are in the middle of the greatest human genocide in the history of the human family. And we cannot stand by and let that happen, because if we do, we fail the test of our humanity and certainly the test of the American ideal.
So, Trent Franks, let me ask you, is the Republican leadership receiving that message? Do they understand that this is not going to work?
I think they do, but there's nothing that we should take for granted. We should do everything we can to emphasize that to them. But ultimately, the bigger issue, not the bigger issue, but the bigger problem here is this motion to proceed to consider in the Senate, this 60-vote rule and the filibuster, because the Senate Democrats either can stop us cold or sow seeds of sabotage and into the process, not the least of which would be the one we're discussing now. And it just completely distorts the entire process. We do not have accountability. We do not have clarity. It's like mixing dirt and ice cream. It never is something that works. And we've got to, as a people, deal with this, because the filibuster was put in place years ago to allow a vote, and they kept lowering the number because we got more and more polarized. We are so polarized now that to require the Senate to be able to even put things on the agenda to require 8 Democrats is foolishness. We've got to do something different, or otherwise it's not going to work. We're not going to be able to save the country if we don't do that, and we've got the best opportunity in the world, and this is the time to do it.
If you missed any of today's program, you can find a link to it by heading over to TonyPerkins.com. Also, while you're there, sign up for Tony's Washington Update. It's a daily email highlighting the important issues affecting your faith, family, and freedom. Well, that's it for this week's show. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
The weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you've heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can help support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 866-372-7234.